Just a quick word from our sponsor, Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. It's HIPAA compliant and loved by over 6,000 clinicians across all medical specialties. I love the backstory of Freed too. It was a computer engineer who saw his wife, Gabby, a physician, charting and decided to create Freed. It listens, transcribes, and writes a note for you in less than 30 seconds. It actually even learns your style and adapts that note that it gives you for editing. The reason I love it is honestly, I'm so exhausted by the time I get to documentation and always appreciate that Freed catches important details that I may have forgotten to document by the time I got to it. With Freed, documentation no longer has to be a burden. Try it today. You get 10 notes for free. See the difference. And after that, it's $99 a month. But Core IM listeners get 50% off the first month by using the code CORE50. People say it saves them hours a day. It's a very small monthly price for the return of your nighttime and your weekend with loved ones. Again, use the code CORE50 to get 50% off your first month with Freed. That's coreimpodcast.com/freed. Again, coreimpodcast.com/freed. And with that, let's get back to the show.
Welcome to Gray Matters, where we unpack how medical management is rarely black or white.
We go on deep dives along the way. I'm Nick Filano, an internist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center.
And I'm Allie Trainer, a pulmonary and critical care doctor at Mount Auburn Hospital. So Nick, I understand we're diving into a case from your past today?
Yeah, that's right. This happened back when I was in residency and still seeing patients in primary care clinic.
Man, so this must have been pretty impactful if it's still something you think about.
Yeah, it was. So I was seeing a 32-year-old woman to establish care. Her past medical history really just noted iron deficiency anemia and some depression. And so, you know, I asked, how are you feeling? And she said, you know, I'm a little tired lately, but who isn't? You know, basically small talk. She seemed like she was at her baseline. And we got some labs, a basic metabolic panel and TSH that were within normal limits. But seeing her CBC made me pause. Her hemoglobin came back at 7.2.
Okay, so it's not an emergency, but still, for a young, healthy woman, 7.2? Most of the chronically ill patients I see have a higher hemoglobin than that. Did she seem okay?
So she was totally unfazed when I told her that her hemoglobin was so low. She basically said that she has had heavy periods for years, and she can tell when her hemoglobin is starting to fall. She knew it was low, and so that's why she actually came to establish care.
Wow. Okay, so how does she know her hemoglobin's low?
She told me that basically she stops being able to complete her normal running circuit. She's making mistakes at work that she'd never normally make, and she's almost falling asleep after lunch.
What? That's crazy. This is her normal life and she just deals with this? That's terrible. So you're saying that she has known heavy periods and this gets so bad that she regularly has severe symptomatic anemia? This is her life?
Yeah, that sounds like an awful thing to get used to, but it's not an uncommon one. When I looked into it, roughly 1 in 5 to 1 in 6 women in the world are estimated to have iron deficiency. According to the WHO, it's actually among the leading causes of years lived with disability in women.
That is insane. I knew iron deficiency was common in women, but to be one of the leading causes of years lived with disability is just wild and seemingly so preventable.
I know. So that's what we're talking about today. How can this debilitating problem that is so easily treatable remains so widespread among women in the 21st century?
Yeah, that's just crazy. So to bring this back to your patient, so clearly we're worried iron deficiency was driving this patient's anemia, but how do we know if that's what's causing her symptoms?
Right, exactly. That's what I was wondering. So we sent her for repeat labs that day. Her hemoglobin was 7.0, so still low. Her MCV was only 71, and now for her iron panel. Her iron was low at 14. She had a ferritin of 23, and a TSAT of 3%.
I want to say that seems iron deficient, but I'll be honest that this is something I could use a refresher on. You know, it seems like iron deficiency is a slam dunk when you're like, oh, their ferritin's 5. I know what this is. But oftentimes the numbers are all over the place or borderline, and honestly, I don't know what to do with it. So like, do I use ferritin, percent saturation, both?
Mm-hmm. Or TIBC, or one of the dozen other RBC indices that used to feel like extra channels in a cable package to me. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, right? That iron deficiency is this really common thing. And I think we all approach diagnosing in different ways based on how we were taught or what our institution calls normal. Of course, that led me down my first deep dive. The simple question of how do we diagnose iron deficiency? Spoiler, I lied. It's not so simple. Iron deficiency is its own disease, and anemia is just one way it presents. And the anemia is actually a really late complication.
The available iron is prioritized to heme. And when there's a deficiency in available iron, it's taken away from other either developmental or functional processes. So in the adult, or in the human, it's taken away from brain function, from heart function, from muscle function.
That was one of our discussants, Dr. Malcolm Monroe.
Hello, my name is Malcolm Monroe. I'm a gynecologist, clinical professor at the University of California, Los Angeles.
So outside of making heme for red blood cell production, the body actually uses iron for cellular respiration. That's important for organs like the muscles and the brain. And yet still, if iron is low, the body will shunt iron to heme at the cost of the brain. The body hardly ever makes the brain ride shotgun.
Wow. So what you're saying is if your hemoglobin drops, the body has used all the backup iron it has. And if you're anemic, your iron levels are really low.
Iron deficiency, anemia, is the extreme end of the iron deficiency spectrum. And indeed, cognition is compromised, physical function is compromised even before anemia occurs.
Man, that is crazy. So what you're saying is that I can blame how confused and tired I was during pregnancy on my ferritin of 7? I'm working on that, by the way.
Yeah. I had no idea that these neuropsychiatric symptoms could show up before you got anemia.
Yeah, iron deficiency anemia has always just rolled off the tongue as almost one word, so I am definitely going to need to unlearn that. Because iron deficiency can be in its own thing even without anemia. So with that in mind, I'm guessing we should start with the iron panel then?
Yes, definitely. So first, I want to examine the most commonly used test, ferritin. A quick refresher, ferritin is a protein that lets us store iron until we need it. So the iron that's stored in the liver is stored as ferritin. But the ferritin that we measure is the small amount that's circulating in serum.
So I think most people are familiar with the ferritin test, but I think the real question is, what is the best way to use it?
Well, the WHO weighed in on that in 2020. They released guidelines and recommended using a ferritin cutoff of 15 to diagnose iron deficiency.
And it's true, that has a very good specificity, 99% specificity for iron deficiency anemia, that it's the cause of the anemia. But it was only 59% sensitive. So you were missing a huge percentage of people who would have benefited from iron by using such a strict cutoff for ferritin.
That was our second discussant, Jason Fried, a hematologist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, who many of you listeners know, but he's trying on a new hat today as discussant.
Now, how did that become the cutoff in the first place if that has such terrible sensitivity? Well, it's mostly because the way cutoffs are established is by taking a lot of healthy people and finding a 95% confidence interval of the ferritin in that population. The problem is that a large number of healthy women have iron deficiency, even when they're not anemic. And so as a result, we have created these cutoffs for ferritin that are really, really too low.
Wow. Okay. So essentially our reference range was created by taking a population that included iron deficient women and calling them healthy?
Yeah, I didn't know that either. And like, I get no test is perfect, but my instinct would be to use a higher cutoff and optimize sensitivity, even if we're doing it at the cost of some specificity.
So, you know, kind of like going up, like ferritin less than 25, it's more sensitive, 73%. Ferritin less than 35, 80%. Ferritin less than 45, 85%. And even when you get to the 45, that's still pretty specific. It's still 92% specific. So, you know, I think 45 is a pretty good number to have in your head as being like, well, if it's less than 45 in someone who is anemic, you can be pretty confident in your decision to give that patient iron.
So makes sense that any ferritin cutoff we pick is going to have its own sensitivity and specificity. But if a ferritin of 45 gives us a sensitivity of 85% and a specificity of 92% when compared to bone marrow biopsy, why not use a ferritin of 45?
Yeah, and so it actually happens that 45 is the ferritin level recommended by the American Gastroenterological Association to diagnose iron deficiency in anemic patients. And there's actually some physiologic data to back that up too.
Because that seems to be when our bodies essentially stop absorbing any significant amount of iron. It sort of goes down to this basal level of like, if your body considers itself fully replete around then, such that it just absorbs some like minimal 5% amount of it, but it enhances it anytime you're less than 50. So clearly the body wants iron if you're less than 50.
It's great that this ferritin cutoff of 45 captures more people, but that makes me wonder about patients with a ferritin in the gray zone. You know, maybe it's 45, but what about 60?
Yeah, I actually talked to Jason about that. And he pointed out that, you know, when it comes down to it, iron's a relatively safe treatment. So if your suspicion is high enough and the testing is not quite definitive, you can go ahead and just treat and see if patients respond.
That's a strategy that I think is often undervalued, is this idea of a time-limited trial of iron. But it's actually endorsed by the British Society of Gastroenterology guidelines on iron deficiency anemia. We recommend that a good response to iron therapy, like the hemoglobin going up more than 1 g/dL within 2 weeks in anemic patients, is highly suggestive of absolute iron deficiency, even if the results of iron studies are equivocal. That recommendation had 100% consensus and had a statement strength of strong. So that's the group where I really think that time-limited trial of iron I use the most often is when they're in that 50 to 100 range, because those are the perfect people to see, are you right about your diagnosis before you start ordering a million other obscure tests for anemia.
Okay, so for me, the takeaway here is that it's reasonable to use a ferritin cutoff of 45 because it has more sensitivity without sacrificing much specificity. And then if maybe the ferritin's in the 45 to 100 range, a time-limited trial of iron therapy and rechecking to see if the hemoglobin responds can confirm your suspicions.
Exactly. And to give you a specific number to keep in mind, the British Society of Gastroenterology said to look for a rise in hemoglobin of 1 g/dL in 2 weeks. Side note, there will be a whole Five Pearls episode next week on the nuances of iron deficiency treatment. Okay, so there's obviously other tests that hint towards iron deficiency. Things like a low reticulocyte count as the body struggles to make red blood cells or an elevated TIBC. But in most cases, the ferritin alone can be really helpful. But I do want to point out one more clue towards iron deficiency that our basic labs can give us, the mean corpuscular volume.
People actually have fairly stable MCVs through their life. And so if someone's MCV drops from 95 to 86, you know, it went from definitely normal to also definitely normal, that's actually a meaningful change that is often another clue that they are developing iron deficiency, because not a lot of other things cause your MCV to change.
I never knew you could use MCV that way. I may need to pause this episode and go check on all of my patients' historical CBCs. Okay, so I feel like there's an elephant in the room for me here. Most patients I see are in the hospital, which means most also have inflammation. And we know that ferritin is an acute phase reactant, so it's high in these patients. So what do we do here?
Okay, so with inflammation, we're getting into a lot murkier waters, where ferritin is hard to interpret as a way to diagnose iron deficiency. And you know, the little data we do have is mostly in those with CKD, HFrEF, and IBD.
Yeah, and then this gets extrapolated to all of the wildly different inflammatory processes we see.
Yeah, like do the ferritin cutoffs we use for those patients apply to a patient who is found down for hours, who has DKA and bacteremia, or, you know, all the other one-liners in my list in the hospital?
Right. So poor data extrapolated from a specific patient population and applied to all inflamed patient populations is not great. But I have this number in my head of a ferritin of 100 to 300 being used to diagnose iron deficiency in inflamed patients. Is that a ferritin range we should be using?
So using the data we do have, in 2017, the American Journal of Hematology published a consensus recommendation. That suggested using a ferritin of less than 100 or a ferritin of less than 300 with a TSAT less than 20% to diagnose iron deficiency. But here come the caveats. One, this was specifically for patients with chronic heart failure, CKD, or IBD. And two, again, this was a consensus expert opinion.
So ferritin is still helpful in chronic inflammatory conditions, but it sounds like it's not as helpful. Like we're not going to be hanging our hat on it as much when inflammation is in the mix. So I'm guessing we're going to have to turn to other iron tests. You had mentioned the TSAT. Can you remind us what that is?
Yeah. So briefly, transferrin is the protein that transfers iron around the body, hence the name. TSAT essentially estimates how much of the iron is taking up all of the available binding sites on transferrin. You know, it's like, how full is the bus?
Okay, so the thought being that if you have iron deficiency, then iron isn't taking up as many binding sites. But what do we consider a low TSAT? I feel like I've heard a range of anything between 15 to 20%.
Yeah, depending on where you look, it seems to vary. I found 15 and 20% both listed as the lower limit of normal. And it seems like this traces back to a study in the 60s that looked at 130 patients with no iron in their bone marrow and found that their TSAT tended to be 2 to 16%.
So a low TSAT in those patients gives me a little bit more confidence to sort of make a presumptive or suspected diagnosis of iron deficiency that I'm going to test with a therapeutic trial.
Okay, so for patients without inflammation, TSAT can be sort of helpful, but it's not as persuasive as the ferritin. But it sounds like you're saying that for patients with chronic inflammation, the TSAT can help us out?
Yeah, so if you think about it, transferrin is a negative acute phase reactant. So inflammation lowers transferrin, which means less available binding sites for iron. And that means a higher TSAT. And so conversely, if you have a low TSAT, despite all of that, it can suggest iron deficiency.
So takeaway is, for patients with inflammatory conditions, the evidence is not as strong and guidelines are mostly expert opinion extrapolated from patients with CHF, CKD, and IBD. However, a ferritin cutoff of less than 100 or less than 300 with a TSAT less than 20% is the current recommendation we have to go on.
Right, exactly. And you know, I think the jury is still out for figuring out when iron deficiency is complicating chronic inflammation. And honestly, even with these cutoffs, we're probably still missing a lot of iron deficient patients with CKD. But back to my patient. With a ferritin of 23 and a TSAT of 3%, she seems to have pretty clear iron deficiency.
But what is causing her iron deficiency? I mean, I know that she said she had heavy periods, but are they heavy enough to cause this much iron loss?
Yeah, I had the same question and pretty much no answers when I first saw her. Like, when does menstrual bleeding become heavy menstrual bleeding? And how do you even take a good menstrual history? And so that led me down my second deep dive on how to evaluate a patient for whom heavy menstrual bleeding is suspected. So Allie, I'm going to start with a really basic question I was asking myself. How likely is it that my patient's iron deficiency is from heavy menstrual bleeding? I mean, is it that common that women become iron deficient from menstrual bleeding alone? And I was thinking about this, and then Dr. Monroe told me about a study from the 60s that was conducted on 110 healthy college-aged women.
They managed to do bone marrows on all of these healthy girls who were not, they were just volunteers. 70% of them had virtually no iron in their bone marrow. None or virtually none. 7-0.
Wow, so these are just average healthy women?
Yeah, not only that, but the hemoglobin cutoffs that we use probably miss a lot of anemia in women anyway.
The WHO defines anemia for our men as less than 13 and women as less than 12. And then if you look at that, it's all based on this one study, but then they actually gave all the women iron and they gave all the men iron. And it didn't shift the hemoglobin lower limit of normal for the men, but it shifted it for the women basically to be equivalent to men.
That's Dr. Angela Wyand, our third discussant.
Hi, I'm Dr. Angela Wyand. I'm a pediatric hematologist at the University of Michigan.
I can't believe the hemoglobin ranges for men and women come from a study in the 60s, and that women who had, quote, normal hemoglobin had improved hemoglobins after iron supplementation, and that these reference ranges for men and women 60 years later are still different.
I know, it's kind of mind-blowing. The good news is that the WHO is reviewing their guidelines on anemia, including how sex and age affect a normal hemoglobin. More to come in the future.
So the CBC is not a great screen for iron deficiency. And in fact, hemoglobin ranges may falsely reassure us. So how should I know to suspect iron deficiency in a woman with a normal CBC?
Yeah, good question. A good history is really the key to finding iron deficiency before anemia develops. You won't always find classic symptoms like hunger for things like ice, also known as pica. But if a woman is reporting poor sleep, fatigue, depression, not being able to work or exercise, just a general poor quality of life, know that all of these things have been associated with iron deficiency and heavy menstrual bleeding.
A lot of these symptoms of like sleep disorders, restless legs, some of the like mood things that are associated with iron deficiency, people think have to do with actual like how much iron is getting into your brain.
It sounds like lots of women are living with these effects of low iron in the brain. And your patient reported that she basically lived with daily fatigue and depressive symptoms even before her hemoglobin dropped.
Yeah, very true. And, you know, even if we had caught my patient before her anemia developed based on those symptoms, the million-dollar question is still, how do we determine if the iron deficiency is due to menstrual losses? I mean, how do we diagnose heavy menstrual bleeding?
I can think of the questions we're taught to ask, like, you know, how many days do your periods last? How many products do you use? But I don't really know what I would do with that information. Like, what am I looking for? And when is it actually considered heavy?
You're definitely not the only clinician who feels underprepared to take a menstrual history. Surveys have shown that not all women even agree on what is considered light or heavy bleeding.
They did a big, really international survey a few years back, and like 41% of girls, parents of girls, like never talk to their children about menstruation, right? So there are people who start their periods and no one ever even told them that was going to happen, let alone what would be expected in terms of how much bleeding they're having.
So if both patients and clinicians are struggling to communicate during menstrual history, maybe we can start with the basics here. So what is heavy menstrual bleeding exactly?
Historically, they defined heavy menstrual bleeding as more than 80 milliliters per cycle, but clearly no one's measuring how much.
Yeah, I definitely do not do that. I mean, it makes sense to have an exact definition for studies, but it seems totally unreliable and impractical to measure menstrual losses in milliliters.
The National Institute of Care Excellence in the United Kingdom developed the definition that we use, and that is bleeding of sufficient volume to adversely affect quality of life. And you can break that down into what part of quality of life, but quality of life, sexual function, physical function, cognitive function, having to abstain from activities, etc.
Yeah, it seems so much easier to ask someone, hey, do you have to stay home from work the first day of your period? Rather than, hey, how many milliliters of blood loss do you have?
So I always start with open-ended just to kind of get a sense of what they think about it. And then I kind of say, like, this is going to like feel weird, but I just need to get a lot of information about how much they're bleeding. I'm just kind of interested to know like what they think about their periods. And it really is fascinating because, you know, I would say at least half of the patients that I see who have really abnormal periods, if you just say like, how are your periods? They'll say fine, normal, I'm not concerned. And then those are the same patients who then, like, you find out they bleed for 3 weeks at a time. And they just have no idea that that's not what's supposed to happen.
Wow. So much to learn from these open-ended questions. And then what are the specific questions that are the highest yield?
I think the biggest piece of advice I have for people is just like, you have to ask so many detailed questions because we have a lot of adolescents who change their products all the time because it grosses them out to see the blood, right? So if there's any blood on the pad, they change it. So things that I typically get more concerned about are bleeding for more than 7 days, having to change products more than every couple of hours. Other things that are concerning are like clots that are bigger than the size of a quarter. If you're having to change overnight, having accidents or having like a gushing sensation, which most people that have heavy bleeding, like the second you say that, they're like, yes.
To summarize here, when taking a history for heavy menstrual bleeding, we want to know if heavy flow is affecting a patient's quality of life, and we should ask them this directly. It can also be helpful to ask the patient how they feel about their periods in their own words. Then we can get more specific and ask questions about heavy flow, such as bleeding for more than 7 days, passing clots larger than a quarter, episodes of gushing, or overnight accidents.
So what happens is women are given these ways of compensating. Or the word we're using is adapting. So they adapt to their loss by putting on these extra pads and all this sort of thing. So you have to also take that into account. No, it doesn't adversely affect my quality of life because I wear a diaper.
Right. Also ask about adaptive behaviors like changing products every couple of hours or wearing extra products or protective padding.
Okay, starting to feel like I have a better handle of how to take a menstrual history. So what did your patient say when you asked her about her menstrual history?
So she definitely did feel that her life was affected by her menstruation. She reported bleeding for 7 to 10 days per cycle with clots that were frequently dime-sized but occasionally quarter-sized. She had to change her pads 5 to 6 times per day, but she had no gushing or overnight accidents.
So we've established that she has iron deficiency. Her menstrual bleeding definitely seems to be heavy, and she's clearly symptomatic from both. And this has probably been going on for years, so seems like we should start treating her.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But Dr. Monroe reminded me that I wasn't quite done with my workup.
Heavy menstrual bleeding is not a diagnosis. It's a symptom, just like headache and abdominal distension, etc. It's not a diagnosis at all, just a symptom.
Okay. So it's not like heavy menstrual bleeding is the singular entity. It's the manifestation of so many different things: bleeding issues, fibroids, cancers.
In adolescence, like the most common causes of heavy menstrual bleeding are like anovulatory cycles, coagulopathy, things like that, versus like structural causes that you would think of more in older adults, where, you know, you worry more about things like malignancy or endometriosis, you know, those sorts of anatomic things that you don't see necessarily as much in adolescence.
The differential for heavy menstrual bleeding is so important, but it could also be its own episode, and it's definitely more than we can get into here. But I did find one takeaway from our discussions particularly surprising.
I'm always kind of thinking about, like, does this person have von Willebrand's disease? Does this person have, you know, another underlying bleeding disorder?
And the next question then is that lifelong? Was that with you your whole life? If the answer to that is yes, then there's a really good chance they have a coagulopathy, a bleeding disorder. And if you look at von Willebrand, type 1, 2, 3, all, you know, the whole von Willebrand spectrum, that's about 13% of women with the symptom of heavy menstrual bleeding have von Willebrand's.
That is way more common than I thought.
Yeah, I know, right? And so basically, once we've diagnosed heavy menstrual bleeding, our job is not done. Something's causing that bleeding, and it's usually something treatable. Finding it can mean one less person living with chronic fatigue, depression, and insomnia.
So did you get to the bottom of your patient's heavy menstrual bleeding?
Okay, so here's what I learned. She did have a history of heavy and irregular periods for most of her life. She didn't really have any significant family history. Her coagulation tests and TSH were normal. She did actually report having a low von Willebrand's factor once, but repeat testing was normal. She also had a reassuring pelvic ultrasound. Ultimately, she was referred to gynecology and she had an IUD placed with presumption of an ovulatory disorder as the cause of her heavy menstrual bleeding.
All right. I'm really looking forward to a happy ending to this case. So did that help?
Her heavy menstrual bleeding? Yeah, definitely. Her periods totally stopped with the IUD in place and she was so happy. She was started on iron supplementation and her hemoglobin and her ferritin improved.
That's amazing.
Yeah, well, don't get too excited yet because her labs improved but didn't quite go to normal. And then they got worse again.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, she came back when I wasn't in clinic to review that her ferritin was still in the 20s. So my preceptor ended up sending her for a double endoscopy. And they found a 3-centimeter nearly circumferential mass in the ascending colon with signs of recent bleeding.
I'm shocked. So she had heavy menstrual bleeding, and now we find out there was a colon mass this whole time?
It was such a surprise. Even more so when the pathology showed colonic adenocarcinoma. I mean, fortunately, it was localized. She had a right hemicolectomy with negative margins, and she did well.
I'm glad to hear that, but this is so uncomfortable to sit with. I mean, this poor woman's entire ordeal, and honestly, the biggest thing is how easy it would have been to miss this.
I know. I was so relieved that my preceptor made the call to send her for the scope. But I kept wondering, you know, would I have done the same thing? And so for our third and final deep dive, I want to ask, when should a premenopausal woman with iron deficiency be referred for endoscopic evaluation?
Just a quick word from our sponsor, Factor. Spring is here, and I want us to all imagine spring where mealtime stress is a thing of the past, where gourmet, nutritious meals await you, no prep or cleanup required. And this is where Factor steps in, transforming your mealtime into a stress-free experience. With Factor, you get to enjoy chef-prepared, dietitian-approved meals that are ready in just 2 minutes. I use it for my family weekly, and I can attest to how tasty the meals are, even for my three-year-old. You get a weekly menu of 35 different options, plus you can indulge in 60 add-ons from breakfast, snacks to beverages. And on top of that, this April, you can celebrate Earth Day with Factor all month long. You can choose their Earth Month Eats for meals with the lowest carbon footprint. So are you ready to eat stress-free? Head over to factormeals.com/coreim50. Use the code coreim50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off the next box. Again, use the code coreim50 at factormeals.com/coreim50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while the subscription is active. Now with that, let's get back to the episode.
Yeah, if I have a patient who's older or who isn't menstruating, this feels like a no-brainer. New iron deficiency means you need an endoscopy and colonoscopy. But for younger patients with iron deficiency, I don't really know at what point I would recommend a scope. And she had another cause. She had heavy menstrual bleeding.
Right, exactly. I mean, most people would agree that an older patient with new iron deficiency needs a scope. I mean, we're worried about missing cancer or the polyp that could turn into cancer. But I was curious, when we do those scopes, how often do we find something? And so Jason told me about this study from 2017, and it's pretty compelling data. This study enrolled over 4,500 asymptomatic patients of all ages, men and women, with a hemoglobin less than 9. And so they all got an upper endoscopy and colonoscopy. And if those were unrevealing, they then got a video capsule endoscopy.
When they did that, 89% of patients had a cause identified for their iron deficiency anemia. 89%. It's crazy, actually. And of the patients, 13% had cancer. So a big chunk had colorectal cancer, but also people had gastric cancer, esophageal cancer. So this dogma that you have to rule out GI cancers is totally right when you have unexplained iron deficiency anemia. Now, those aren't the only important diagnoses to make. There are tons of other diagnoses that are important to make, right? There were a ton of people with colitis. There were a ton of people with stomach ulcers who needed treatment. There are tons of people with duodenal ulcers that needed treatment. There were a ton of people with celiac disease. Again, these are people who weren't clinically suspected to have celiac disease.
Yeah, I guess I don't really think about the fact that often, and actually in the study more often, a GI evaluation for iron deficiency finds these other important things like colitis, ulcers, and celiac disease.
Yeah, and remember, these were iron deficient men and women of all ages with no GI symptoms. And relevant to us, premenopausal women were included, except for those with known heavy menstrual bleeding.
I guess the question we're getting to is, when should we refer patients with low iron and no GI symptoms?
So there are guidelines from the American Gastroenterological Association, and the first answer is that all adult men and postmenopausal women with new iron deficiency of unclear cause deserve an endoscopy and colonoscopy.
I mean, that makes sense, but premenopausal women are their own category for a reason.
Good instinct. So let's start with what most people agree on. Just like we said before, if a premenopausal woman has iron deficiency and GI symptoms, then yeah, a GI evaluation makes sense, and that's often going to include an endoscopy and colonoscopy. But what if that premenopausal woman with low iron has no GI symptoms? Then what do we do?
One thing I will say, though, and the guidelines support this, is even if you have heavy menstrual bleeding, it is worth checking young women for celiac disease serologically, right, with a TTG IgA antibody, because celiac disease is much more common than we used to realize.
Okay, so all iron deficient women deserve serologic testing for celiac and an evaluation for signs or symptoms of GI disease to see if further testing is needed. But if they don't have GI symptoms, I'm still really struggling with who needs a scope, because on the one hand, menstrual bleeding is still the most common place that they're losing iron. But on the other hand, sometimes these GI pathologies can be silent. So I guess a question that might be helpful is understanding how common are things like colitis, ulcers, celiac, or even GI cancers in young women?
That's a great question. And I found it surprisingly hard to get an answer. There was a study from 2006 where about 250 asymptomatic premenopausal women with iron deficiency had endoscopies, and about 6 to 7% of them had a relevant finding, with only one cancer.
Okay, so we're not seeing the 89% positive rate that the other study we talked about showed that included all age groups, but endoscopies are still making diagnoses in this women. And one out of those 250 women actually had cancer. And I know that's not a ton, but it isn't nothing either. I mean, isn't colorectal cancer also getting more common in young people?
Yeah, it seems to be, but the specific numbers are hard to find. One study quoted a 0.1% risk of colorectal cancer in men and women under 50, and another pooled 10 studies together and found a 1% risk of GI malignancy in premenopausal women with iron deficiency. And that's a lot higher, but that included people with GI symptoms, which is probably a higher risk group. So colorectal cancer is more common in young people than it used to be, but how common is it? Specifically in asymptomatic premenopausal women? Unclear.
I mean, if we scope every iron deficient woman without GI symptoms, that would be millions and millions of women. Costly, logistically challenging, and scopes aren't harmless. You know, serious complications are rare, but they do happen. So there isn't a strong recommendation driven by data. But how do the experts advise us on which premenopausal women with iron deficiency should have a double endoscopy?
So those American Gastroenterological Association guidelines do give us a conditional recommendation for upper and lower endoscopy in premenopausal women with iron deficiency anemia. This assumes that there is no other, quote, unequivocal cause of iron deficiency anemia. And I thought this was really interesting. They say that the benefit of endoscopy in iron deficiency anemia quickly diminishes as age declines, and therefore the harms of endoscopy will eventually outweigh the benefits. But there's no reliable data on exactly what that age threshold is.
Yeah, I understand where that guideline comes from, but I don't know how to apply it. I mean, when does a cause of iron deficiency become the unequivocal cause? And at what age should we start recommending endoscopies?
I think this is where things really start to get gray, and you're going to get different opinions here. So let's see how our discussants approach this question.
You could stop their periods and give them IV iron and kind of see, right? Like, at least do like the things that you can do to try to like tease this out. And then if like, oh, they're miraculously better and they still haven't gotten into CGI, maybe they don't end up needing to have to CGI.
I recommend it for women over age 40. For women between ages 30 and 40, I really usually would address their heavy menstrual bleeding first and replete their iron. And if they develop recurrent iron deficiency anemia after that, then I would certainly send them for a GI workup.
For young women, let's say below 40, where the prevalence of colon cancer is extremely low, unless their Lynch syndrome or with some other inherited high-risk circumstance, some other, you're really thinking they're heavy menstrual bleeding. In that 10 years, that decade from 40 to menopause, you know, the incidence and the prevalence of cancer increased.
So I like the idea of approaching this stepwise. Instead of putting pressure on ourselves to have an answer right now, you might need some time to know if this woman has heavy menstrual bleeding and if treating this will improve or cure their iron deficiency. But that balance tips more towards pursuing a scope at the age of 40 and beyond.
So if I can summarize here, for men and postmenopausal women, new iron deficiency should be evaluated with double endoscopy to look for cancer, but also things like colitis, ulcers, and celiac. In premenopausal women, we should always be evaluating for heavy menstrual bleeding, as this is the most common cause of iron deficiency, and it's also worth sending celiac serologies.
And double endoscopy may be indicated if that woman has GI symptoms, if they don't have heavy menstrual bleeding or another obvious cause of blood loss, or if stopping the heavy menstrual bleeding doesn't cure the iron deficiency. It should also be considered if they're 40 years or older, or if they have another factor that increases their risk of cancer, like a genetic disorder or family history.
So how is your patient doing now?
She's doing well. She recovered well from surgery to remove her colon cancer, and when I last saw her, the IUDs had stopped her periods. Her ferritin level is finally normal.
That's amazing. I'm so glad to hear that. This poor woman has been on such a roller coaster ride.
Oh, truly.
I'll start summarizing what we've learned. In Deep Dive 1, we looked at different ferritin cutoffs. We said that a ferritin under 45 increases sensitivity when compared to a ferritin of 15. And ultimately, checking whether iron deficiency improves with treatment after 2 weeks is a great way to confirm that your patient has true iron deficiency.
Using time as a diagnostic test is such an important component of longitudinal care of patients in general, but it turns out to be extremely helpful in iron deficiency in a number of different ways. Both the example we talked about earlier, the time-limited trial of iron, seeing if it works, using that as a diagnostic test, but also looking for a recurrence after you've fully repleted someone as a way of finding occult blood loss that you might not have gone after up front. And so I really think that, you know, doing this thoughtfully can really help you, like, not excessively over-treat and, you know, do a million things for everybody.
That reminds me how accepting that we may not know everything in the moment and appreciating time as a diagnostic tool is so undervalued. We also discussed that the evidence is much less clear for diagnosing iron deficiency in patients with chronic inflammation, and a ferritin cutoff of less than 100 or less than 300 with a TSAT of less than 20% is the current expert opinion.
In Deep Dive 2, we discussed that iron deficiency is common in women and often due to heavy menstrual bleeding. And specifically, look for bleeding that lasts more than 7 days, changing products every few hours, passing clots larger than a quarter, episodes of gushing, accidents, or adaptive behaviors. I was amazed at just how unbelievably common it is and how much it affects people's lives.
Society has normalized suffering through your periods, right? And so that's just like what happens. That's what it takes to be a woman. Like, what are you going to do, right? Like, we would do something about that. Like, I have patients who I've had such horrible periods, like they drop out of school. Like they just stop going to school. And you're like, like that shouldn't ever happen. But it does.
this is important to keep in mind. And I also think one of the biggest takeaways for me as a pulmonologist is that I'm often the one seeing these young, healthy women in pulmonary clinic because they come to me for shortness of breath. And I'm routinely checking PFTs and sending a CBC to look for anemia, but I don't check iron studies. But after doing this episode, I'm definitely going to be checking iron studies going forward.
It is so easy to get focused on what we own in medicine, you know, to stay in our lane. But iron deficiency is a problem that really reaches across several specialties.
I think everyone stepping up to own or do their part in iron deficiency is a great goal to keep in mind.
I think most countries, maybe all countries, have been saddled with this silo-ization, normalization, lack of awareness of impact. We just need to get everybody, as many people as we can, under one tent to kind of become aware and then figure out how we deal with some of these questions like the ones you're answering.
And in Deep Dive 3, we reviewed that premenopausal women with iron deficiency deserve an evaluation for signs or symptoms of GI pathology, celiac testing, and consideration of an endoscopy if a patient is over 40, has a risk factor for GI cancer, or if her iron deficiency persists once the heavy menstrual bleeding has been addressed.
And that's a wrap for today. If you found this episode helpful, please share with your team and colleagues and give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. It really does help people find us.
If you have a case you'd like to bring on air, please email us at hello@coreimpodcast.com. Thank you, Dr. Jesse Powell, for the awesome accompanying graphic on iron testing and the reminder on how to take a good menstrual history. Thank you to Dr. Bhatia for the audio editing. Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.